I think at this stage we've done the basic introduction of the family lineage of Imam Khomeini. We've talked about the religiousness, the esteemed authority that the family that he comes, and as you say, you take it right back to the family tree, going back to the Holy Prophet's family. So this is not a minor thing. This is something very significant.
I think if we could look at his father's own actions, would show how they replicated through Imam Khomeini's life.
Right, and we'll do that, dear listeners, in the second program about Imam Khomeini's father and his prominence in the town of Khomeini. But we thank you very much for listening at this moment in time to our program, The Man Who Changed the World. And certainly, he shaped it for tomorrow. And thank you very much for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. May the peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all.
An eatery in Japan is giving disabled people a new lease on life by including them in its workforce. Dawn Cafe uses robotic staff controlled remotely by people who are handicapped. Around 50 people with mental and physical disabilities help run the cafe. The pilots come from all over Japan as well as overseas. The venue was established with support from major companies and crowdfunding. It has become more than just a place to eat for its customers.
Customers here are not exactly coming to this location just to meet the Orihime robots. They come here because of the people behind Orihime, and they will come back to see them again.
For Kentaro, Dawn Cafe has a very personal touch. In his childhood, he was left unable to go to school due to a period of bad health. Now he aspires to come up with ways to further the inclusion of disabled people in society. Crowds of visitors and conservationists have been delighted by the birth of a rare orangutan in the Spanish town of Fuengirola. The new residents of the safari park made its first public appearance 2 weeks after its birth. The baby, yet to be named, is the only one to be born in a European zoo over the past 12 months. The park has launched a program to conserve Bornean orangutans that are considered as a critically endangered species. Their population has declined by more than 50% over the past century. Dozens of baby turtles have made their way to the sea after an unexpected overnight hatch in Italy. Italian volunteers were surprised by track marks of the hatchlings from an unknown nest in Sicily. Some of the eggs hatched in the morning. An environmental group following the turtles' movement said that 74 hatchlings made it to the sea, while 5 didn't. The reptiles are an endangered species of oceanic turtle that also live in the Mediterranean Sea. Their population has declined in recent years due to hunting, loss of beach nesting sites, over-harvesting of their eggs, and being caught in fishing gear.
A Slovenian enthusiast has discovered a new cave in the Alpine country, which is staggering visitors by its awe-inspiring looks. Ludvik Husu, a 63-year-old cave explorer, has come across a cavern that runs 60 meters deep in the ground. It's located in the country's karst region, an area of land made up of limestone. some 14,000 caves are buried under the Green Forest of Slovenia, hiding away breathtaking stalactite and stalagmite formations. The limestone region is so pristine and uncharted that the European Space Agency has used the caves to train astronauts.
Yeah, astronauts.
Astronauts also know that the karst world is exceptional, special in a similar way to how a space environment can be. It is an unknown environment where you do not know what to expect at your next step. They have been here to train for precisely that, how to help yourself in a dark area where you're not sure what's going on and everything is new. That's very good training for space, and they have been very pleased to be able to prepare for something they might find in space.
Over 150 species, some looking like alien creatures, have been discovered inside the cave systems. They include an ancient aquatic salamander called the Little Dragon that can live up to 100 years. The animal was previously considered living proof that dragons had once existed. Some cave systems in Slovenia stretch for tens of kilometers. They are so winding and deep that scientists say large parts of them remain undiscovered despite exploration efforts dating back hundreds of years. As the U.S. is experiencing its worst heat wave, Boston zookeepers are working extra hard to keep the animals cool to avoid overheating. Some get frozen treats, and some, like the yak, get a water hosing several times a day when the temperatures rise. The hardest part is cooling down animals belonging to cold climates, like the reindeer. Since reindeer don't like water, the hosing down is a big no. Instead, the poor animals sit in front of a desk fan all day to stay away from the heat. The birds have it a little easier as they spend most of their time in air-conditioned dens.
In Indonesia, a group of university lecturers have come up with an idea of building a robot to help people during the coronavirus pandemic. The robot is assembled from electric household items like pots and pans and an old television monitor. It was named Delta after the new coronavirus variant ripped through Indonesia. The robot was initially built to entertain residents of a village in the country's East Java province. But the head of the robot-making project says he decided to shift his function into assisting people dealing with a deadly virus.
With this new Delta variant and the surging number of COVID-19 cases, I decided to turn the robot used for public services into one that sprays disinfectant and delivers food and necessities of residents who are self-isolating. I'm shifting the function to serve only the members of the community who are in need.
The interesting thing about a robot is that it greets people when delivering things to isolated residents. The developers of the robot say it has been built in a joint project with local people and is by no means a high-tech device.
We don't know much about woolly mammoths that went extinct some 10,000 years ago, except their scant references in archaeology books. Now scientists have discovered that the giant mammals could walk incredibly long distance. Scientists from the University of Alaska have concluded that a male mammoth named Kik covered enough ground in its 28-year lifespan to encircle the Earth twice. To come up with the data, paleontologists analyzed one of Kik's well-preserved tusks. They say the animal lived with a herd through its infancy and youth and then went on to live alone. Scientists hope they will learn more about mammoths by analyzing further data from Kik's remains.
After an epic 17-month journey that drew international attention, China's famous herd of wandering elephants has finally returned home. Wildlife protection officials said the elephants safely crossed the bridge over the Yuan River to reach their protected habitat. The Asian elephants also received a little encouragement from wildlife rangers to help them get home. Staff used corn trails as bait and built artificial roads to ensure the herd took the right route. The 1,300-kilometer odyssey that began in March captivated audiences with several highlights. One of the highlights was the birth of a calf in November. In June, drone footage was captured of the 14-member herd as they were sleeping outside of a village.
The Light is a short bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
The world's oldest wooden boat belonging to Egyptian pharaoh King Khufu has been moved to its new home in a painstaking transfer process. It took 48 hours to move the 20-ton vessel to the Grand Egyptian Museum from the Giza pyramids. It was carefully fixed inside a metal cage and carried on a remote-controlled vehicle. The 4,600-year-old vessel, also known as Solar Boat, was not built to sail through seas. In ancient Egypt, pharaohs commissioned solar boats, which were essentially virtual vessels, to transport them to the afterlife. To fulfill their purpose, they were buried in pits next to royal burial chambers. Prehistoric cave paintings found in Spain proved that Neanderthals were the first artists on Earth. A new study says red markings discovered in three caves near Malaga did not occur naturally. They were made by Neanderthals nearly 65,000 years ago. That's when modern humans did not inhabit the continent yet. The findings suggest that the pigments were applied at different times, sometimes more than 10,000 years apart. This shows that Neanderthals returned to the site over time to make symbolic markings.
I believe that this art made by the Neanderthals will be also found in other caves around the world. This non-figurative art, which we have not paid attention to, may be precisely the oldest art in the world. So this place in Spain is one of the caves with the oldest art in the world.
Researchers say the pigments are yet another evidence that the intellectual capabilities of Neanderthals have been underestimated. Neanderthals went extinct about 40,000 years ago.
Egypt's forgotten art of Batik is undergoing a revival thanks to a designer who has been working hard to bring the ancient cloth decorating technique to life. Working tirelessly in a small workshop in Old Cairo, Samer Hassanyan has enhanced the art of batik over the years. Samer is one of the few designers in Egypt to use the traditional method to design on fabrics. The art consists of patterns created by applying melted wax onto cloth before dipping it in dye or painting over it with a brush. The fabric is put into boiling water in order to melt the wax. The ancient Egyptians used the batik fabric mostly to wrap the coffins and mummies. However, the difficulty of mastering the art caused its disappearance.
Batik has disappeared in Egypt because no one shared their skill. As a teacher, I find that it is very important to provide as much training as I can because people realize how difficult it is when they start learning the techniques.
Samer has now a skillful artist in her workshop who designed colorful fabric using the technique. Samer says her goal is to produce unique designs that are particularly identified as to Egyptian and represent the country's rich cultural heritage.
Artists in an Egyptian village work hard to keep alive the ancient tradition of making papyrus paper despite a tourist downturn amid the coronavirus pandemic. The village of Karamus in northeastern Cairo is the largest hub of papyrus production in the country. Many of the residents of the village are involved in farming, processing and decorating papyrus planted in 25 farms near the village. The Pharaonic era tradition includes cutting strips from the plant, pressing them together and drying them to form a sheet. The artists then decorate the papyrus to create beautiful products for tourists. However, the industry has been affected by the coronavirus pandemic, forcing the artists to use more creativity.
We are trying to think out of the box to keep this profession alive. We made products out of papyrus paper, like wallets, notebooks, drawing sketches, new products, so we can keep going.
The artists have also launched online stores to sell their new products. Papyrus producers say they have lost nearly 80% of their income in the last 2 years. However, they say they will never stop making papyrus and will make every effort to keep the ancient cultural tradition alive. You can find tin boxes in every house, with people often throwing them away after consuming what they had inside. But an old lady in Belgium has turned it into her obsession, an obsession for years to fill her home with these fascinating containers. 83-year-old Madame Dardenne has gathered around 60,000 vintage tin boxes in a span of 30 years. The empty containers of all sizes now occupy four other houses. They once used to hold all kinds of goods, ranging from coffee, biscuits, tobacco, tea and soap to shoe polish, are now piled high all over the building that belongs to Dardenne. Some of these boxes, according to her, come from as far as India and Japan. Dardenne says it all started with a chocolate box that was given to her with a painting of a blonde girl in a blue hat.
I consider this box to be the first of my collection. It is a box of Belgian Côte d'Or chocolates that a relative of my husband gave me, believing that I was interested in boxes.
She sees the boxes as history books with decorations and writings on them describing major events and reflecting contemporary culture. The collection is the largest in the world, listed by the Guinness Book of Records. Located in eastern Belgium, the museum can be visited by appointment. Humans have damaged the environment perhaps more than any other species, but there are always some who go out of their way to help animals in distress. Juan Carlos Rodriguez and his wife run a sloth rescue center in the lush outskirts of the Venezuelan capital, Caracas. They have so far saved over 45 sloths. The couple decided to start helping the furry mammals last year after running into a sloth that had been badly injured. They saved him and called him Chewy, after a character in the popular Star Wars franchise. Juan and his wife are now alone in their life-saving journey. are not alone in their life-saving journey, as their vet friends also help them with services and donations. The coronavirus pandemic has disrupted lives all around the world, but it's important to try to stay fit for humans and animals alike. Penguins in an open zoo in Thailand have been keeping their daily routines, although no visitors are allowed due to COVID-19 restrictions. They are regularly taken out of their air-conditioned enclosure so they can enjoy a walk or swim. The 41 flightless birds consume nearly 25 kilograms of fresh fish each day. The cute animals at the zoo are aged from 1 month to 18 years old.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. For most of the last week, in defiance of the worst foreign policy crisis of his young administration, the president, who won the White House on a promise of competence and compassion, has had trouble demonstrating much of either. The chaos in Kabul and his own conflicting message have left President Biden struggling to assert command over world events and seemingly more intent on washing his hands of Afghanistan than expressing concern over the humanitarian tragedy unfolding in the country. The article you're about to hear has been written by Peter Baker, the chief White House correspondent for the New York Times. The piece is titled, Biden Ran on Competence and Empathy, Afghanistan is Testing That. Most of the last week, in defiance of the worst foreign policy crisis of his young administration, the president, who won the White House on a promise of competence and compassion, has had trouble demonstrating much of either. The chaos in Kabul and his own conflicting messages have left President Biden struggling to assert command over world events and seemingly more intent on washing his hands of Afghanistan than expressing concern over the humanitarian tragedy unfolding in the country. Mr. Biden's team argues that it will not matter in the long run because Americans agree with his decision to pull out after 20 years of war and do not care what happens in Afghanistan as long as their fellow citizens are extracted safely. Afghanistan is America's longest war, stretching through four presidencies, and none of those presidents found a way to disengage successfully. But the tumultuous endgame of President Biden's withdrawal has nonetheless undercut some of the most fundamental premises of Mr. Biden's presidency. That, unlike his erratic, self-absorbed predecessor, he brought foreign policy seasoning, adults-in-the-room judgment, and a surfeit of empathy to the Oval Office. I just had the feeling that he was so wrapped up in the decision itself that he forgot the basics of implementation, said Leon Panetta, the former defense secretary who served alongside Joe Biden in President Barack Obama's administration. The American people may be with you on that decision, but if they see chaos in Afghanistan, they're going to be very concerned that the president doesn't have his act together. David Axelrod, a former strategist for Barack Obama, said he had no doubt that most Americans agreed with Joe Biden that it was time to wrap up the Afghanistan operation. The way it's ending, at least thus far, is more problematical, he said, and cuts against some of his core perceived strengths: competence, mastery of foreign policy, and empathy. It's as if his eagerness to end the war in Afghanistan overran the planning and execution. After days of withering criticism from allies as well as adversaries, Mr. Biden tried to repair some of the damage on Friday, 20th of August, with a half-hour appearance in the East Room of the White House, where he asserted that the evacuation operation had made significant progress, while acknowledging that images of desperate Afghans chasing planes and handing a baby over barbed wire have been heartbreaking and gut-wrenching. Faulted earlier in the week for not consulting with allies, Joe Biden made a point of noting that he had now called the leaders of Britain, Germany, and France. Mocked for spending time at Camp David, where he had gone for summer break, while Afghanistan fell to the Taliban, Joe Biden delayed plans to fly Friday afternoon to his home in Wilmington, Delaware, until Saturday, 21st of August. Leon Panetta said Joe Biden seemed to have realized that he had mishandled the message, at least, and needed to make adjustments. I just had a sense that he was back on his feet today as opposed to earlier in the week, Panetta said. Beyond repeating that, "The buck stops with me," however, President Biden conceded no mistakes of his own and again deflected the harsh reviews by focusing on his desire to end the war in Afghanistan rather than directly addressing what many consider the botched execution of that decision. "There will be plenty of time to criticize and second-guess when this operation is over," Biden said. "But now, I'm focused on getting that job done." As he has all week, President Biden made assertions seemingly at odds with reality. His description of a smoother evacuation contrasted with a continuing confusion at Kabul airport, where flights were halted for hours on Friday, 20th of August, until they resumed later on in the day. His claims that there was no question about credibility with NATO allies belied the deep frustration in European capitals. And while President Biden held the degree of precision of the operation, he could not say how many Americans were still in danger. Those comments came after other suspect statements earlier in the week, a month after he said it was, quote, highly unlikely, unquote, the Taliban would take over Afghanistan and there was no circumstance that would lead to a chaotic Saigon-like exit. President Biden told George Stephanopoulos of ABC News this week that chaos was in fact always inevitable. While multiple reports indicated that military leaders argued to keep a small force in Afghanistan rather than pull out entirely, Joe Biden insisted that no one said that to me that I can recall. At points, the president has evinced little sense of the human toll as the Taliban swept back to power in Kabul. Asked about pictures of fleeing Afghans packed into planes and some even falling to their deaths after trying to sneak abroad, Joe Biden interrupted. "That was 4 days ago, 5 days ago," he said, when in fact it was just 2 days earlier and hardly made less horrific by the passage of a couple of sunsets. While largely disavowing any errors, Joe Biden instead has pointed the finger the now deposed Afghan government, the vanishing Afghan security forces, and even Afghan civilians who he said resisted being evacuated earlier. He has avoided blaming the Taliban, presumably to avoid antagonizing them whilst executing the evacuation. Losing the public perception of basic competence can be hazardous for a presidency. George W. Bush certainly learned that during the mishandled response to Hurricane Katrina in 2005. Donald J. Trump critics never considered him particularly apt in office, but his handling of the coronavirus pandemic certainly undermined him further. Joe Biden's stumbles have been particularly striking given the longtime senator and former vice president brought more experience in national and international affairs to the White House than any newly inaugurated president in more than three decades. But his aides maintain that Americans will look beyond the turmoil of recent days to the bigger picture. What Americans are seeing is a president who has the courage of his conviction that this is the right decision for our country, even when that decision is hard, said Kate Bedingfield, the White House communications director. They are seeing a president who promised to end America's longest war and kept his word, and who takes responsibility when things don't go perfectly because the buck stops with him. The Biden team's cold political calculation is that the outrage expressed by the Washington political class and the ghastly images shown by the national news media will have little lasting effect on Americans, who will soon forget the messy departure but remember that the president got the United States out of a failed war. They may be right. By Friday, newspapers in places like Phoenix, Fresno, Jacksonville, Minneapolis, and Providence had no stories about Afghanistan on their front pages. Americans historically have not voted much on foreign policy unless it directly involves Americans, which is why Joe Biden's main priority has been to get his own citizens out of Afghanistan without casualties or a hostage situation. Biden thinks he gets away with this as long as there are no Americans that are killed on the ground, which is a big if, because a lot of things could go wrong, said Ian Bremmer, president of the Eurasia Group, a geopolitical risk firm. Ian Bremmer added, "But I happen to agree with him. I think that's right." At the same time, he added, "I'm amazed at how he's mishandled this with the allies." The political danger for President Biden may be that the chaotic exit from Afghanistan provides fodder for a broader Republican argument that he's not up to the job and has left the United States humiliated on the world stage. The pictures of bedlam are like political manna for campaign advertisement makers, with no doubt will try to paint Joe Biden as another Jimmy Carter. Some of those who have criticized Joe Biden nonetheless said that the final verdict was yet to be written. It will hinge, they said, on whether he can ensure the safety not just of Americans trying to leave the country, but also the Afghans who worked with the United States over the past two decades, even if it takes longer than Joe Biden's 31st of August deadline. The president still has a lot of agency over how this will be perceived and the impact of our reputation for compassion and competence, said Representative Tom Malinowski, a Democrat from New Jersey. Malinowski added, "It all depends on whether he's willing to do what it takes and to allow our military to do what it's capable of doing. That chapter, of course, will be written over the next few days and weeks."
Ashura in Britain.
Part 2.
In the year 680 AD, in the middle of the dry desert of Karbala, a man and around 70 of his followers were surrounded by an army of several thousand.
They all knew, even the women and children in that camp knew, that the enemy was not only ready to fight, they were ready to kill.
He knew that he was going to get killed. On the night of Ashura, he told his companions that tomorrow all of us are going to be killed. So anyone who wants to leave, let him leave.
Over 1,300 years have passed since this event, but Imam Hussein's brutal death is still commemorated every year. The day is known as Ashura, and remembering its message has spread across the world, including Britain. Why?
If we just let that message to be lost in the books of history, have we not betrayed Hussein? Have we not betrayed the grandson of the Prophet?
Karbala may have marked the end of Hussein's life as his heart stopped beating in the dry desert, but it was the birth of a powerful message. The message of a man who sought to rectify what had gone wrong. It is a story that has captivated the world.
For most people, it's very emotional. You can't really say add to it, except we should try and emulate Imam Hussein.
What we see in Karbala is a manifestation of the human spirit in its most Fitri state, a yearning for justice. And so the events of Karbala, they don't only pull on our hearts, but they pull on our minds, they pull on our emotions.
The Quran criticizes Jews for killing their prophets, which history records that they killed many of their prophets. Criticizes the Jews for killing their prophets. And I think one of the criticisms to Muslim Ummah is that they killed someone like Hussein, the grandson of the Prophet, peace be on him.
I have a lot of sadness to think that he was the Prophet's grandson and that he was murdered by the caliph of his time, and that it was an act of political violence and was a senseless death in its way.
It's the most moving event, and it's an inspiration.
After Hussein was killed, people almost immediately began to sense his message. The first impact was felt in Kufa by those who had betrayed him or had turned back on their pledge in helping him. A large group of around 5,000 people who called themselves the Tawabun, the Repentant, realizing the enormity of what had happened, decided to take arms to fight against the Umayyads. The second impact was even larger and took place in Damascus, in the very palace of Yazid. Hussein's sister Zainab, who was captured along with the other women of Hussein's camp, began to publicize the news of Hussein's death. She also defended his cause so powerfully that those companions of the Prophet who were still alive, and even Yazid's household, were appalled by what had happened.
Well, the agony in Imam Hussein's story is that he was killed by a Muslim. He is the martyr who wasn't killed by a non-Muslim.
The impact that this tragic event had on Muslim community is tremendous. The shame of killing a person like Hussein ibn Ali for not paying allegiance to a person like Yazid, not putting up any fight or anything like that, just for not paying allegiance.
The impact of Hussein's message didn't just affect the Umayyads, but also anyone in the future who would try to distort the Prophet's legacy of justice. It quickly became a tradition to relate accounts of the brutal treatment of the Prophet's grandson and to defend his cause. People who heard these accounts would sit and mourn.
People find when they come to listen to lectures, when they come to remember Imam Hussein alayhi salam, when they come to remember what he went through, what he said, they find upliftment, they find spiritual gaining, they find motivation and inspiration for them to be good Muslims, to be role model Muslims in society, and to preach Islam and to understand Islam better.
In the vast expanse of the Muslim world, people would remember Hussein with grief and compassion. Seeing this, the Umayyads attempted to mark the day of Ashura as a day of celebration for their victory over Hussein. But then, something happened that was to shake the Umayyads to their very core. A trend was developing. Now, even those who had inherited the custom of celebrating Yazid's victory were beginning to commemorate Hussein's defiance. This has now reached Britain.
Everyone's come here to celebrate and commemorate the death of Imam Hussein and to remember him, and this is our call to the world that we'll never forget Imam Hussein. And he stood against terrorism that day, and we're today standing against terrorism with all this walking and all this marching.
We are inspired by the example of people like Imam Hussein and the martyrs. We are inspired not to give in to evil. We are inspired to resist. We are inspired to oppose and fight and combat evil. And so to me, that is very meaningful, very important, very significant.
I think it's something strange, which I don't think is ever going to happen again, as you would not expect 72 people to go in war with over, like, 20,000 people, and it's just the way that they hold on as much as they could without any war or anything, and they just saved our religion.
The way him and his family were butchered, like, you could use the word butchered, really, the way they were butchered in Karbala, it's just so heart-wrenching.
As the commemoration spread, Hussein's name became etched in history. He became the symbol of justice. And visiting his place of martyrdom became a ritual. During the Abbasids, the second Muslim dynasty, visiting Hussein's place of martyrdom became so popular that in 850 AD, the Caliph Mutawakkil ordered his forces to destroy Hussein's tomb, to punish anyone who visited it, and to wipe Hussein's name from the pages of history.
If we do not pass on this message by the commemoration of this event, I think we have betrayed Hussein, as the people of Kufa betrayed Hussein. And certainly we do not want to betray the grandson of the Prophet. And we have the duty of passing on that message.
There's nothing in Islam or in the Sunnah of the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, his family, that prohibits remembering him and his family. You have gatherings, people remembering the great exploits of certain companions as well. So people will gather together to hear about to learn and hear about the lives of the companions. So I can't quite see what is the problem for gathering together to learn and hear about the heroic actions of his own family.
Attempts to wipe Hussein's name from history was proving difficult. It seemed to only add to people's sympathy for him. Then, in 963 AD, everything changed. In Baghdad, people rose up and poured into the streets, beating themselves and wailing for Hussein.
Because of the passion and feeling of the community, Muslim community, this was kept alive. And now it has spread everywhere.
Soon, artificial fountains were set up in cities, towns and villages to remember the thirst of Hussein and his family. People would drink from these fountains and would remember Hussein with tears in their eyes. In the 14th century AD, during the Mongolian Timurid dynasty, the commemoration of Ashura had spread to the vast Sunni population of Khorasan. Also, a man called Mullah Hussein Kashifi, arguably one of the most popular Sunni scholars of his time, became famous for his book, Razatu Shuhada. This book depicted the graphic events of Karbala, albeit with exaggeration.
The whole commemoration ceremony in Iran is called traditionally Rozakhani, that is reciting Roza, referring to the book of Mullah Hussein Kashifi, Rozatu Shuhada. And nowadays, of course, people here, we go to Rozakhani session, that's reciting Roza. They don't know what does it mean.
People had now developed an unstoppable passion for Hussein. Exaggerations gradually crept into all aspects of the story, the ceremony, and the mourning.
We shouldn't just make this as a passion play. We have to convey the message of Hussein, peace be upon him. We have to discuss what he meant.
Today, when people do gather together, it's not just going over the past again. It's bringing the whole spirit of the event into our lives.
Various cultures and local customs began to influence new traditions of mourning. From people hitting their heads with swords, wounding their shoulders, and walking on hot coal. Islamic scholars condemned these practices as unnecessary. But it just didn't stop. Today, the centuries-old tradition of commemorating Ashura has spread across the world, particularly in Indonesia, Egypt, Turkey, Iran, Kuwait, and Bahrain.
as well as throughout America and Europe, including Britain. It seems that Ashura's message was global.
I think the message has a universality, because the experience of suffering and martyrdom are common to all sorts of great religions, maybe all of them.
We are talking about a version of Islam that touches the hearts of the people. And what attracted them in the subcontinent towards Islam was not a sword. That marching procession would inform the people of the entire story of Karbala and how it happened back in those days.
We have had many examples of non-Muslims, and especially the Hindus, who believe that Hussein is not for the Muslims only. Hussein is for us. Hussein Sabka. He says, Hussein Mera, Hussein is mine. Hussein Dera, Hussein is yours. Hussein Rabka, Hussein is of Allah. Hussein Sabka, Hussein is for everyone.
But the Imam, on the way to his martyrdom at Karbala, invoked the figure of Yahya ibn Zakaria. In Christianity, we call him John the Baptist, who suffered martyrdom at the hand of a wicked man because of his righteousness.
The comparisons between the suffering of Imam Hussein and Jesus Christ were inevitable. In countries around the world, this has led to opportunities for Muslims and Christians to unite in the remembrance of these commanding figures. More recently in Britain, organizers of Islamic ceremonies have invited Christians to their programs to commemorate Imam Hussein.
There were about 9 priests in that program. And when I recite first suffering of Jesus and after that suffering of Imam Hussein, where the night was Shabi Ashur, the 10th night, Muharram, so many Christians, they were weeping. Even some priests, they were weeping. In the church, we finished program at 1:30 night. That priest came and said, "It's wonderful, never happened in church."
To share that, what suffering means to me in my head intellectually, but also in my heart, what it means to me as a Christian and as a human being. And then to hear someone like Maulana Kazmi speak about the suffering of Imam Hussein and the suffering of Jesus as well, I just think it's really very, very important.
As we engage with Jesus' sufferings, then that is something which provides similarity with the Ashura commemorations.
The real life is a spiritual life. Look, the suffering of Imam Hussein and suffering of Jesus. We heard suffering of Jesus. How the 72 people in Karbala, in Iraq,
that sort of demonstrative showing of solidarity, yes, with the historical figure, with Imam Hussein, but also one with each other, can be a very powerful experience.
The emotion is terribly important, and for whatever reason, sometimes we don't let it come out, maybe because we're being too British and we're keeping a stiff upper lip.
Your religion is not a matter of a private sphere. It's not something which you do for an hour on Sunday morning. It's something that affects your whole life. And so I'm all in favour of these great events being commemorated in a public setting.
In the last 40 years in Britain, the remembrance of Imam Hussein has grown. From charities, street processions to conferences, keeping Imam Hussein's name alive seems to be an important activity.
Imam Hussein Council, we are blessed. We've always had the participation from the heads of the states. We've had scholars from all the different religious persuasions, and we've had people from all the different walks of life, all of whom wanted to find out or write about Imam Hussein alayhi salam.
Back in 1974, when I started, the community in London was very small. But there was a need for a center where the commemoration of Imam Hussein's majlises must take place. So the number of people grew.
One of the biggest suffering which Imam Hussein and his family encountered was the thirst.
And therefore, it is our moral duty and obligation to see that each and every family at least get a decent, clean water for the drinking. And Alhamdulillah, Lady Fatima Salamullah Alayha Trust has so far built over 125 wells.
Ashura is no longer for me, or the events of Karbala is no longer about a specific day of the year. It's actually imbued in the work that I do, both as an activist and as a writer. I find those events very meaningful and very powerful, and a huge explanation of what it means in Islam to struggle, and also what it means to really seek unity, a kind of divine unity and the unity of humanity.
I remember in one year I was talking with the police about organization of this session, and he has said we have to change 50 main road for this procession, which is important. And we have a very, very clear message from procession for all people around the world, which is means justice and truth all the time is alive.
We have started about 500, and now Alhamdulillah is right about 4,000, and inshallah every year it's going to increase.
It shows that Imam Hussein's religion is still alive and the belief is still there. That's what this march is about.
Ashura is not just for a Muslim in Iran, it's not just for a Muslim in Iraq, it's for a Muslim and non-Muslim all over the world. I was speaking to my manager yesterday, and she's English, and I said to her, Ashura is not just for Muslims. Gandhi has talked about Ashura. Charles Dickens, a famous English author, has talked about Ashura.
I was very worried today because it was cold, it was raining, and I was sitting at home, very warm and comfortable. And I was worried because I thought the brothers and sisters wouldn't come out. So I thought I really must make the effort, show solidarity and come here. And I'm so cheered. Every year it's grown. It's got bigger and bigger every year, despite it being so cold. I don't think I can shout over this, actually. This is too loud for me. But you should record this. This is fantastic in the middle of London. And it's a great opportunity to emphasize that Imam Hussein... Surgeon. I've been living in the UK for 37 years. It's my home. I'm very comfortable here. And I use the teachings of our Prophet and our Imams, and particularly Imam Hussein and his stand today, 1400 years ago, to guide me. I think it's a principle for us that justice is essential, and you can't live your life without that.
Starting from Prophet Noah, and then by Abraham, peace be with them, and then Moses, and then Christ, and then last of them, Prophet Muhammad, peace be with all of them. The grandchild of Prophet Muhammad was the best of the examples. The spirit of Imam Hussein is about love, love for humanity, love for mankind, wherever you found them.
I come in every year, and I just love it. When I was a kid, my dad used to take me, and I enjoyed him. And for Imam Hussein, I do everything.
I have got a role to play as a Muslim, as a Shia Muslim, as someone who is believing in you have to stand for the truth, and always you stand for the truth. You defend it no matter what. It's unconditional. Always you stand for the truth.
They gave their life to keep our religion, and that's why we're here, and everyone comes here every time, every year, and I hope every year will be the same as well.
It is difficult to find events in history that have been kept so alive. For many people, even hearing the name Hussein gives a sense of hope.
Wherever in my life I feel hopeless, I feel dissuaded, and I feel a bit, if I'm in a low, Imam Hussein alayhi salam is the name that provides me with hope.
Hussein's death has made people think about his life, his character, and how Muslims should spread the legacy of his grandfather.
When somebody went and told the Prophet that, Ya Rasulullah, I'm spreading your message, and the Prophet says, don't do it. He said for the second time, and the Prophet says, don't do it. He said, Ya Rasulullah, I'm spreading your message of Islam. And the Prophet says, don't do it. And he was shocked. And the Prophet said, change your manners. Let your characters be such that a person should come and ask you, excuse me, which religion are you following the characters of? And that should be the message we should continue. Not only the day of Ashura, not during the days of 12 days of Muharram, not during the months of Muharram and Safar only, but 365 days.
Now that Ashura has reached Britain, Hussein's message continues to spread. He is remembered as the great man, the grandson of the Prophet Muhammad. And he gave his life to uphold justice and to defend humanity. What Hussein did on that day, over 1300 years ago, was to speak to the world. And the world heard him.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Amnesty International, in a recently released report, said the Biden administration has shamefully continued the Trump administration's policy of misusing the Title 42 public health authority to block and expel people at the border, recklessly endangering lives. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Kenny Stancil Ryder. This article is published under the heading, There is No Excuse. Amnesty slams Biden over skyrocketing ICE detentions and more than 400,000 expulsions. Stay tuned for more. The Biden administration's treatment of refugees, asylum seekers, and immigrants not only falls short of expectations, but is in urgent need of course correction, particularly its growing reliance on mass detention and widespread denial of access to people requesting protection at the U.S. southern border. Amnesty International USA argues in a new report released recently. President Joe Biden assumed office pledging a fair and humane immigration system, placing racial justice and human rights at the heart of his vision, begins Amnesty's report. Needs improvement, a progress report on the Biden administration record on making the United States a safe refuge. His promised agenda was a stark contrast to that of former President Donald Trump's administration, which used xenophobia to justify punitive and cruel policies that dismantled access to protection for many people. Nevertheless, the Biden administration has yet to act boldly to undo the Trump administration's harm and restore humanity in how the U.S. treats refugees, asylum seekers, and immigrants, says the report.